Hello and welcome to Choose FI. Today on the show, we have a real treat. We have two of our good friends. We have Alan and Katie Donegan, who are co-founders of the Rebel Finance School. And they have both been on the show, Alan, many, many times, under a different topic, though. So Alan has always talked entrepreneurship. And what's fascinating is I was talking to Alan offline, and he was telling me about this amazing amount of data science that Katie was doing around index funds. And it just sounded like such a fascinating topic to bring to the Choose FI audience, because we talk about index funds so much, but do we really know what's in those funds, how they were made up, what comprises them, right? Like all of these things in what has become, for many of us, our biggest financial holding. I think it's important that we learn that. And Katie has spent countless hours diving into this, and I'm just fascinated to have this conversation amongst the three of us. So with that, welcome to Choose FI.
You're listening to Choose FI Radio. The blueprint for financial independence lives here. If you're looking to unlock the secrets to financial independence and early retirement, you're in the right place. Stay tuned and join a community of like-minded people who are getting off the hamster wheel and taking control of their lives in the pursuit of financial independence. Choose FI, your home for financial independence online.
Alan and Katie, so happy to have you here. Welcome back to Choose FI.
We're excited to be here. We've been looking forward to this.
I'm excited to get my geek on today.
Yeah, I'm excited too. We got the little accounting and math geekdom flying, right?
And I'm really looking forward to this index fund thing, because I think in a way it's a bit like electricity. You don't need to know how electricity works to be able to operate the light switch. You just throw the switch and the power comes on. You don't need to know how index funds work to be able to do it. You can just put your money into it. But for some people, the trust, the ability to trust, I'm putting my money into an index fund, where is it going? What's happening to it? And this is where then the panic comes if the market crashes like it has done recently. Like, do I really trust this? So I think it's actually a really important subject to properly understand. We're putting hundreds of thousands, if not millions, into these things. And what is it?
Right. What are these things? And I think this episode comes hot on the heels of having J.L. Collins on the show talking about the simple path to wealth. And like you just said, personally, I've been investing in index funds for 10, 15 years now, easily, probably more than that. I'm older than I think I am in my own head. And I have never, I mean, I've looked at the top holdings, let's say, a VTSEX or an S&P 500 index fund, but that is really the extent of it. And I mean, I have a bunch of questions as well in terms of how were these things comprised at the beginning? Was it an active decision to make it market cap weighted, right? Like there are all these things that like we don't really know about. And again, like you said, Alan, we're putting our hard-earned money investing in these funds for years into decades. It's probably a pretty good idea that we have a little better sense of what's going on.
Well, this all started for us in Germany, in lockdown, in the height of the pandemic in 2020, Katie woke up with a question, which was...
Well, I woke up with a statistical outburst, which I realize is quite unusual. I think most people, when they wake up, maybe turn to their partner and say, oh, how did you sleep, darling? How do you feel? I turned to Alan and said, I wonder how much of our portfolio is in Apple. That was the first thing I said to him that morning. And what I meant by that was, we have all these index funds, and I know that Apple is one of the dominant companies in the funds that we own. How much of what we have is in Apple? And I don't know why I chose Apple, but that was what was on my mind as I woke up that morning. Alan didn't see me for about a week because I was in my laptop downloading data from different places, figuring out how much of our portfolio was in Apple, how much is in Microsoft, how does this even work? How is this weighting work? What are all the different industries? We have a global fund. What are all the different countries that our money is invested in? It just, the floodgates were open, Brad, and there was all these questions that I had, and I set to work on my laptop furiously datering away.
That's amazing. I can imagine hundreds of hours just sitting on the laptop trying to figure this out. And yeah, and yeah, I love the morning wake up. Hey, let's talk about stats, right?
And the first one she went off to look at, nearly all of our wealth is invested in the Vanguard Developed World, excluding the UK. That's the fund we own. And we chose that one at the time because it had slightly lower fees than the global fund. Because we listened to J.L. Collins, we'd listened to your podcast, we'd listened to everything that was saying fees are important, get your fees down. So we chose that one. We didn't even really know what we were investing in.
And I think you can tell from our accents that we're not from the US. These are funds in the UK, which is why we're not invested in VTSAX, because we can't. We don't have those funds available to us. We have the funds that Vanguard UK offers. So that's why those are the funds that we were looking at.
Now, that certainly makes sense. So right, you have these total global indice options. You have, I assume then, a total UK option. Is there something like that? Or is there always a home country bias, I guess, is a general question I've always had.
Yes, there is absolutely a home country bias, no matter where you are in the world. And it seems inbuilt into the industries, because I was speaking to the head of customer service at Vanguard UK recently, and he said when they were setting up, the financial advisors in the UK asked for the life strategy funds, which were home country biased. And the life strategy funds in the UK have 20% UK investments. But the UK only makes up less than 4%. It's 3-point-something% of the global economy. So that's a massive home country bias. And wherever you go in the world, it seems to be people invest in their own economies, even if it's a bad idea. And the UK economy has stagnated for like a decade. It's done really badly. And if we'd have done that, we would be far poorer now if we'd have invested in just our own country than investing in the world and the economic powerhouse, which is the US, which makes up about 59% of the global economy, doesn't it?
Yes. So I feel like those of you in the US, you can get away with having a fund that is only invested in that country because you're so dominant across the world.
It's probably the only country in the world where you can get away with that.
Yes. I think even if the UK had done well, I would still say that it would have been a bad idea for us to invest just in the UK economy because it's such a small proportion of the world economy. And then you don't have that automatic rebalancing if the UK starts to do well or starts to do worse. The beauty of the index fund, especially a global fund, is that the fund will automatically reweight based on how well different countries are doing. So if the US continues its march and continues to be the dominant economy and makes up even more percentage-wise of the global funds, then the fund will just adjust for that and it will own more of the US. If the US starts to be less dominant, then the fund automatically adjusts. And I don't have to spend my time thinking, oh, I wonder if the US is going to do well. I wonder if the UK is going to start to be more successful. I wonder what's going to happen to all sorts of different markets. You don't have to worry about that if you have a global fund that automatically readjusts. With the US, the fact that you are so dominant, you can get away with it just being invested in the US. And I think the fees are so low on VTSAX that you might be like, I'm always amazed, jealous, shocked, upset at how low your fees are in the US. I quiz JL so many times, like, and that's the only fee, right? He's like, yeah, that's the only fee, 0.04%. I'm like, no, come on, this can't be true. He's like, yes, I assure you, Katie. Wow, okay, I'm fully jealous.
It is wild. Yeah, I mean, we're incredibly, incredibly fortunate. Yeah, you said it's 0.04% or 4 basis points is kind of the jargon that people use to describe it. But okay, talk me through this global fund, because I think some people, even here in the US, who again have the options of having a VTSAX or a S&P 500 fund, have certainly options of global funds as well. And that is rather alluring, I think, not in a negative way, but in a, hey, I want to diversify even more. Can you give me a sense of how does that fund, like your global fund, are they buying shares of individual, like VTSAX, for instance, or are they sub-buying X% of Apple as a share of the global economy? I know that's kind of a subtle distinction and hopefully it makes sense, but like, are they a fund of funds in essence? Are they buying other funds or are they buying individual shares when you buy that global fund?
They buy individual shares. Yeah, so it owns Apple and Microsoft and Amazon and Google and so on from the US. And then it individually owns the UK companies and owns all the different companies in countries around the world.
And I think there's an interesting point on diversification here. We had someone come on our course recently and she came back to us and she'd spoken to her financial advisor and said, I just want to invest in the one global fund. And the financial advisor said, well, that's not very diversified, which makes me scratch my head.
Right, that's not intuitive at all.
So the S&P 500 is made up of the 500 biggest companies, or 500 of the biggest companies in the United States of America. VTSEX is made up of all of the different stock markets and every investable company in the US. There's 4,068 companies you buy if you buy VTSEX. And then you look at the global fund, and it's over 7,000 companies that you're buying across hundreds of countries. And in terms of diversification, is one of the most diverse things you can buy.
So the question is, how global is your global fund as well? How many different countries is it invested in? Because you think there's about 200 countries in the world. If I own a global fund, do I own companies in all of those 200 countries? The answer is no. Not all of those countries have developed enough
infrastructure,
stock markets to be able to buy companies in those countries. So there's about 25 what Vanguard terms developed countries. So our developed world fund has about 25 countries in it. And then you look at the global fund and it's about 50 countries.
Okay. So, right. There is a distinction between, right, the developed world fund, which has 25 countries, and the global fund, which has about 50 countries, maybe a little less than that. And this is all, of course, at the time of recording. So, Alan, when you said there are 4,068 in VTSEX, obviously that can change. We're recording this in early to mid-October 2022, and all of this information can change at a moment's notice. But it's all going to be directionally accurate, but at the margins, it might change a little bit. So, but even in those funds, like we're talking about developed world, you're saying the United States, for instance, and this is where I was going with my kind of fumbling around with asking, are they buying specific shares of Apple or et cetera? But there are roughly, we'll say 59% of the world economy is the US. So is it roughly fair to assume that the US would make up about 59-60% of each of these funds? Is it slightly different than that or significantly different? Because this is interesting to me. Like, I enjoy the concept of diversification, especially if I can get it for a nominal fee. Okay, but am I paying for nothing, in essence, when I have the option of VTSEX, which, sure, it makes up 59% of the world economy. And again, it's not just U.S. companies. Sure, they're U.S. domiciled companies, I suppose, but they have worldwide operations. So to think that we're just getting within the shores of the US is kind of naive, right? Like, we actually have a significant worldwide operation. So, like, you know, again, I'm trying to figure this out for myself and all the US listeners, is, does it make sense to have a global fund? And of course, we're not looking for financial advice, Katie, but like, is it actually diversified, or is it just like a glorified US fund in essence?
So the global fund that's available in the UK is comprised 59% of US companies. So look on the flip side of that, 41% of the fund is other countries around the world.
Gotcha. Okay. Well, that's as clear as day.
And then the developed world is about 65% the US, because it's a larger proportion of the developed world. And you get a different balance depending on the fund you get. But the global tracker would be the purest version. It just literally maps out exactly what percentage the different economies are, and you get those percentages within it. And I think the magic that we've spoken about is you don't have to choose. And the same as you buy VTSEX, you don't have to choose which American companies you invest in. And yes, they are global, which is why you are the only country in the world can get away with having a home country bias, because you're buying Apple, and I've got an Apple phone here that I bought in the UK. You're buying Amazon. Amazon's huge in the UK, in Germany, around the world. So the companies in the US are global organizations. And it's fascinating, actually, when you look at the dominance of the big companies in VTSEX. So there's about 4,000, we'll call it 4,000 companies in VTSEX. What number of companies do you think makes up 50% of that as a weighting, Brad? So the size, the market capitalization.
I bet it is somewhere in the vicinity of 200.
Mm, That's very high.
That's very high.
Really? Okay.
Yeah. Only 64 of those 4,000 odd companies comprise 50% of the fund.
Oh my goodness. Okay. So yeah, I probably will be kicking myself for that bad guess, because I could have I had a sense that the top 10 or 15 were somewhere in like the 20 to 30% range. So yeah, I could have guessed, but I assume there was a larger drop off.
I still respect your geekiness, Brad. It's okay. You can still stay in the geek club.
Yeah. There was some rationale behind it, but I was off a little bit. So 64 make up 50% of VTSAX.
Yeah. Yes, because they are the most profitable. They are the biggest companies. They are generating the most profit. So they make it up. And people are always worried about this. You know, there was this acronym you had a few years ago of FANG. Facebook, Apple, Amazon, Netflix, and Google. Netflix has since dropped quite significantly, but people are worried about the dominance of these companies. And if I buy into this stock, all my money goes to these big companies, and I should be worried.
I don't think they should be worried. I think also I'm excited because the new acronym is MAMAR, which is Microsoft, Apple, Meta, Amazon, and Alphabet, which is the holding company
oh
for Google.
MAMAR.
They just make up a new acronym every few months.
The whole point of this is that the index will rebalance if those companies do badly. So Netflix suffered recently, and now they're not as dominant. They're not as dominant in the fund. And then you look at the different industries that are represented in VTSAX, and that is weighted, of course, as well by the dominance of these companies. And technology accounts for about 25% of the fund. There's 11 different industries, and 25% is just one of them, technology. And people think, oh, is that bad? I'm investing so much of my money in these companies. Well, no, because if those companies start to fail, you don't have to guess when and how to change your holdings. It just automatically rebalances. And maybe different sectors of the economy will start to do better, but you don't have to worry about that. It will just automatically rebalance as things change. And if you look at the history of like the S&P 500, so that's been going since 1957. You can see the rise and fall of these different industries. And you can see that as things change, the index will automatically reflect that. So back in the day, you know, in the 80s, when oil and gas was so dominant, then that was such a big part of the economy. But as that started to fall away and technology has replaced it, that just automatically happens for you. You don't have to think, oh, maybe I should buy into a technology fund. No, you don't need to do that, because this one fund allows for that. And will automatically change as things change, and takes any of the like the guesswork or the analysis out of it. You don't need to do that.
Which I think is the beauty of index funds, because at a company level, it rebalances. At an industry level, it rebalances. And if you've got a global fund, at a global level, it rebalances. So recently, you could take the example of Russia has dropped out of the index. And we don't even need to consider that. We don't even need to think about it. It just automatically happened in the background in the index fund. Our money is safe. Our money has continued to perform well, and it's been redistributed to the places that we actually want it to be. And this stuff happens all the time. People are worried about, you know, the major forms of the economy, the recessions, the wars, the things that happen. If you've got a global index fund, you don't even need to think about that, because you're not picking countries, companies, or industries. You're just invested in them all, which, like, for me, that gives me such peace of mind. I don't have to think about which country is going to perform in the future.
Yeah, I love that it is all happening in the background. And like you're saying, you were kind of alluding, like, industries rebalance, countries rebalance. But the beautiful thing is, it's not overt, like, okay, we need to have X percent of Brazilian companies. It's just, it's based on ultimately the results. And as J.L. Collins loves to say, these index funds are self-cleansing, right? So companies go to zero and they drop out of the index, but you can only go down 100%. Whereas a company that does exceedingly well, an Apple or for a time, you know, Tesla or Netflix, but while they were riding high, like, those companies are up hundreds or potentially thousands of times. So that's what's actually very cool about these is I look at it in terms of that rebalancing and the self-cleansing nature. And I just wanted to take a quick sidebar, because this is important. We mentioned this in the J.L. Collins episode, but lest anyone gets confused, this is not a cult of VTSAX. it is but one example of a well-known total stock market index fund. And we made note of this in the JL episode because it's really important. I think some people get bogged down in what they might perceive erroneously as doctrine in the financial independence community. And we at Chooseify are anti-doctrine in all ways possible. So we do believe very strongly, and I believe personally very strongly, in buying low-cost index funds, that fees matter. Like Alan said earlier in the episode, fees unquestionably matter. They severely hamper your compounded return over years and decades, plain and simple. But we are not doctrinaire about, hey, the total stock market index fund at Vanguard, which is VTSAX, is popular because J.L. Collins popularized it in the financial independence community. And that's wonderful. But if you have an account at Fidelity or Schwab or TD Ameritrade or wherever it is, you can get low-cost index funds there. So please don't think that it's VTSAX or bust. That is clearly not the case. But again, why you guys looked and dove into VTSAX, and we're going to put this amazing article that you have on your website about VTSAX and really highlighting all of this data in beautiful visual format. So we'll put that in the show notes for everybody to check out, obviously. But I did want to include that minute-long sidebar here because I think it's really important. And I just want to make sure nobody gets bogged down in that kind of detail that it's only VTSX. That would be the biggest folly we could imagine.
For everyone listening to this, our experience, we've now been running this Rebel Finance School, giving it away for free to teach people about finance for 3 years now. And explaining index funds in words gets you so far. Like people go, okay, I get it. It's a list of companies and da-da-da-da-da, and they get that. But it wasn't until we created these visualizations, which if you're listening to this now, just go to alandonegan.com/VTSAX. And Katie has created these charts. The first one you'll see is called a tree map. And each box represents a company by size. And each color you'll see on that tree map represents the industry. And when people see this and they roll their cursor over the top of it and they can see, oh, 5.62% of my money goes into Apple. So if I invest $100 into VTSAX, I get $5.62 of Apple stock. Oh, that makes sense now. And I get this much of Microsoft and I get this much of Tesla. And you can roll over and actually see what the index fund is made up of. And I think that's the piece I really want people to get. It's like, look at what it is. You can actually see your holdings, scroll over it and know exactly where your money is going.
Yeah. And I have to say, I suspect very strongly, even for non-data geeks like us, this is a really compelling and useful and just fun visualization of this. I have to say, like, I am still looking at these boxes and astounded at, oh, wow, I can't believe that company that I've never heard of is 0.32% or 0.23% of the fund. It's pretty wild to really see this. And yeah, like you mentioned, there are some significant percentages here, right? Like Apple is well over 5%, Microsoft is 5%, Alphabet's 3%. So I mean, we're talking almost 14%. It looks like about 14% of your money goes straight to those three stocks. So basically, for every $100 you put into VTSAX in this case, you're buying about $14 of those three stocks, which is interesting. But again, my thought, guys, would be to be a little worried about that, like at first. But again, that goes back to our conversation. And I'd love for you to almost allay my fears again of like the rebalancing, the self-cleansing, like all of those good things. But like, is there any cause for concern in that, just how specified this is with those major, major companies? Like, is there any reason that somebody out there should be concerned? Or is this just the way it works?
Do you own VTS? Which index fund do you own, Brad?
Well, I own a bunch, but I definitely own VTSAX.
Okay, cool. And so 14% of your money is going into those three companies. Would you rather have your dollars exactly evenly distributed over those 4,000 companies?
I don't believe that I would.
Because if you did, your dollars would be evenly distributed across all of the companies, and you would be buying more of the ones that are less profitable.
Right. Well, less profitable or smaller market cap? I guess it goes hand in hand, right? But is it smaller market cap or is it less profitable?
I suppose it comes back to, so market capitalization is the number of shares multiplied by the share price. That's how you get market capitalization. So if you look at the share price, the theory is that all the information about that stock is contained in the price. So how well that company will do in the future, how many dividends they'll pay in the future is all encapsulated in that price. So you could argue that the higher the share price, the more, well, the more valuable the share by definition, but the more you want to own that because the market as a whole has decided that that is a valuable thing to own.
Yeah, they've looked at how much money that company has made in the past and they're making predictions about how much money it's going to make in the future. And they go, this company's really profitable. Like they have for decades made fortunes and they're going to continue to doing it. Look at those different bits.
And when you say they, this they is the market as a whole. There's no like mysterious people behind the scenes going, Maha, let's decide what the share price is for Apple or Microsoft. No, it's combination. All of us, thousands of people operating in the market, like decides in inverted commas what the share price should be.
Yeah, no, I hear you. And I'm partially playing devil's advocate. I'm partially like putting myself in the shoes of people who have these questions. But I can understand it from a perspective because, okay, it's all well and good to say that this is, we have a purely rational market. And you guys are not saying this by any means. But, you know, some people will be like, oh, this is a purely rational market and every piece of information is known and this all makes sense. But that said, the PE ratio on some of these high-flying technology stocks are massive to the point where I'm not sure. I mean, personally, and again, we've seen like a Netflix or a Tesla get smacked down recently, but I'm not sure that either of those companies have any kind of significant moat that isn't just going to get whittled away. And if they have some crazy PE ratio based on, oh, they're technology stocks, even though, you know, are they really? That to me seems irrationally high. Like, so again, if I'm putting for every $100 that I put in, and because the rest of the market is, again, in my hypothetical here, is insane about these couple of companies or companies of their ilk, am I really getting what I want when I invest, when I think that I'm investing in the entire United States and everything we manufacture and all of this stuff? Like, how much is actually the manufacturing? How much is whatever the heartland of the country and the backbone when 20 some odd percent of my dollars are going to these companies that are maybe dubious at best? So again, that's kind of like a strong, like a crazy, like taking it to its logical extreme argument. But there are a lot of people out there asking that when they invest in these large cap funds, which is what, sadly, that's what a total stock market index fund ultimately is, right? Because it's an 80% analog for the S&P 500, which, as you said, 50% of this is made up of only 64 companies as it is. So like, I guess that's a very long-winded way of saying, like, are we as diversified as we think we are?
So let's go right to the top level. And then I'm sure Katie will have lots of details and stats for us. There's a very famous piece that was written called The Drunkard's Walk. And it was a huge analysis of the stock market that basically said, no one can predict which way it's going to go. So if you are, imagine you are on a road and you've got a drunk person trying to walk down the line in the middle, you can't tell whether they're going to go left or right because they wobble. And you can't tell with the stock market whether it's going to go up or down. And whoever predicts, they'll get it wrong occasionally and they'll also get it right occasionally. And the whole thing is you just can't predict. We can't predict, Brad, which companies are going to do best in the future. And Tesla did incredibly well for a while and then came back down. And who's to say it's not going to do incredibly well in the future or incredibly badly in the future? And this is, I think, the key element here. Stop predicting. Like, if you are going, okay, I don't know which stocks are going to do well, but I am nervous that all my money is going into these top 64 companies, whatever it is, you are then saying, I think I know better than everyone else in the world, and I'm going to invest my money in these traditional industries in the Midwest or whatever it is that I think will come back in the future. And no one knows. No one knows which way this is going to go. No one could predict that the big fall in 2020 was from a pandemic. No one expected, well, maybe they did, but not many people expected Russia to invade the Ukraine and the inflation to happen the way it did. And we just have to stop picking. And the way you do that is just buying the companies by the weighted average in the market. Then you are not picking. You're just using a mathematical equation to get average returns. And Katie will tell us the sectors. She's got a wonderful chart on that VTSAX page, which shows all the different sectors.
Yeah, so as we said, technology accounts for a quarter of the fund. 25% of the fund is made up of technology companies. They're so dominant. But then you've got consumer discretionary, meaning people buying stuff.
Which does include Apple, I think.
It includes Amazon.
Amazon, sorry. It does include Amazon because Amazon sells stuff to the public.
And Tesla and Home Depot.
It includes
and Costco.
Tesla, yeah. And then you've got healthcare, which is nearly 15% of the fund. Industrials, which you kind of touched on just now, Brad, is 13% of the fund. And there's these 11 different industries, and you can see the breakdown of them. And it's interesting the point you made, Brad, about how much of the share price is rational. It's kind of what you said, wasn't it? And I love the analogy that J.L. Collins has of a pint of beer, and you can't see into the beer, but you know some of it is froth, and you know that some of it is the actual beer, and you can't tell how much is the froth and how much is the beer. You can't really know like how much is the hype around this stock, which is influencing the share price. And I guess, as Alan said, kind of like, well, what's the alternative? Are you going to start choosing the stocks that you think are going to do well? Are you going to start buying them? As Alan said, like, are you just going to buy them unweighted? Are you just going to buy every single company that you can? I guess, yeah, it's like, what's the alternative to these weighted index funds?
And the alternative would be stock picking. It would be buying equally across the companies. And none of the alternatives sound very good to me. But no, I do no. not want a disproportionate amount of my money in a random tiny company, which Katie looked up what was the smallest company in VTSAX.
Ooh. Yeah, so the VTSAX is, because it is market cap weighted, it's obviously dominated by those bigger companies. But if you look at how big those companies are, the largest is Apple at 2.1 trillion. That's the market capitalization. So the number of shares times by the share price, 2.1 trillion. And then you go all the way down to the smallest, which is only 3 million. And that's a very cool company name called Fat Brands Inc., which is a restaurant company. But it just shows the range and the scale and the difference between the sizes of the companies.
Yeah. And then comes the question, do you want equal money going into Fat Brands Inc. versus Amazon or Apple? And for me, I want to be buying the profitable companies. I'm not saying Fat Brands Inc. doesn't make profit, but that tiny company is not going to make the profit of an Amazon or a Microsoft any day of the week.
Yeah, and I think the point is super compelling of we want to be the opposite of active investors, right? So I think that is the biggest issue when we try to let our brains override maybe our lizard brains override our sense of like, oh, I know better than the market. And I can time this because you've got to time it right multiple times on the buy, the sell, the every, like, it's so preposterous to assume that we, with our tiny little limited knowledge, can outsmart the market. So that is super compelling to me. It's also super compelling. I think a lot of people say, oh, it would be cool if it was equally weighted. But when you look at this and you say, okay, if there are roughly 4,000 companies, for every $100 that you invest in VTSAX, you would be getting about 2.5 cents of each of these companies. So you'd be getting 2.5 cents of Amazon and Apple and 2.5 cents of whatever this Fat Brands or whatever you guys just mentioned. I'm not even sure if I got that right. But I mean, that seems more ludicrous, certainly, than investing in, as you're saying, the winners. But, you know, again, like there's always nuance. Guys, there's nuance to everything, right? Because I can understand the person who's saying, I don't want 2% of my money going to the cult of Elon Musk. Plain and simple. I don't. But on some level, you have to take the quote unquote good with the bad. Because again, that's active investing. And if you want a broad swath of the market based on how significant a percentage these companies are of the entire US economy, then you have to take the quote unquote good with the bad, even though many people would say Tesla is good, right? So yeah, that's a very long-winded way of saying, like, anytime we try to active invest, I think it sets us up for failure because it's just not, it's not doable over an extended period of time.
And I think just building on your Tesla example is, if you don't like Tesla, don't try and remove them from your index fund some way. Just don't buy a Tesla. If enough people stop buying Teslas, they won't exist anymore. That is a much more powerful way, I think, than saying, oh, I'm not going to invest $2 out of my $100 in Tesla.
And let's just have a look at where index funds are going, because there is some dangerous trends in index funds and where this is heading. So the future of index funds is where you will be able to go through the index and tick a box as to which companies you want in or out of your index. So index funds in the future, it's coming, they will be 100% customizable, which is stock picking. The whole purpose of this is, don't pick stocks by everything, because if you start picking, you'll pick ones that win, you'll pick ones that fail, you will lose from this. And sort of the steps on the way, the index fund companies try to keep us excited and get us to invest with them by coming up with new products. So they're constantly selling new products to us. The big one for a long time has been ESG funds, and someone, the benchmark company, someone out there comes, goes through the index and goes, these companies meet the ethical, sustainable, and governance criteria, and these companies do not, and we drop them out. And just for some fun, we did a lot of analysis on the ESG funds, Brad, to see what was actually in there and what wasn't. Of the 10 biggest companies in the UK, so these are the powerhouses of the economy that make most of the profit, they're the biggest ones. How many do you think of the top 10 companies in the UK are dropped out of the global ESG fund?
We're dropped out. So I suspect it's either going to be the extremes, like zero or nine or 10 or something.
It was actually 7 of them.
Were dropped out?
Yes, yeah, 7 of them were dropped out. So if you buy the ESG fund, 7 of the biggest powerhouse companies in the UK, you are no longer buying.
That's very surprising.
It's quite interesting when you look at the names. I'm sure you've heard of HSBC. They're a big global bank. They get dropped out of the ESG fund. Have you heard of Diageo?
That I have not, actually, no.
Oh, they're a big alcohol company. They produce some of the biggest brands around the world. Guinness. I don't know if you've ever had a pint of Guinness.
I have. I've been to the factory in Dublin.
They're a fairly profitable company. And whether you believe in alcohol or you don't believe in alcohol or whatever it is, like, they are being dropped out as a thing. And the further we go with these index funds, the further we're moving away from buying the total market, because you're no longer buying the total market. As soon as you start to choose a type of index fund, a flavor of index fund, you drop things out, you add things in. And I think this comes back to the simplest, cheapest, vanilla option of index fund is the best in our particular mind, because it just, you buying the whole market, you're not stock picking.
Yeah, I think it kind of gets to the point of, what are we looking to do when we invest in some of these alternate funds? It's easy to pick on the ESG because, you know, that you guys spent a lot of time there, and I understand the purpose and I think it's laudable. I genuinely do, but it's just more of stock picking in essence. And I think that's what we're trying to get away from, right? So what are you actually looking to do when you invest in an ESG fund? Are you trying to maximize your return? I think that's hard to argue. Are you looking to, like, this actually goes back, Katie, it's funny, it's the opposite side of your example with the Tesla, right? So if you don't want to invest in Tesla as part of your mutual fund, don't buy a Tesla. I think there's probably the alternate way of saying, if you believe strongly in these causes, you should buy their products, you should support their company, you should share them on social media. I think that, to me, and obviously to each his own, right? But to me, that seems like a much more effective method than buying what would potentially be a suboptimal investment strategy that's stock picking, and that almost by definition is going to have a higher expense ratio than a VTSEX or the like. So it just, it doesn't seem to pass the smell test for me in that regard.
Yeah, I agree. You're moving away from the pure idea of an index fund, which is that it's diversified across all industries, all sectors, and all different sizes of companies.
And I think what would be interesting is if we did a thought experiment for a second, Brad. imagine there's a company that we decided was doing bad for the economy. If we choose not to invest in it, but people are still buying their products, will that company survive? They're making profit. It'll just keep going. If we decide not to spend money with it as a collective, how quickly will they change?
You would think fairly quickly, certainly.
Well, they'd go bankrupt if they didn't, because we would all stop spending with them. And I think this is the bit people have got confused, is it's your spending that makes a difference. It's not your investing in this particular model. Your spending. If we could convince everyone in the US, if there was one particular company that we thought did really bad with for the environment, and we all stopped spending money with them, they would go out of business instantly, or they would change their bad practices instantly. It's the spending, not the investing, that makes the difference. So I'd actually argue invest in the simplest, purest way, and then focus very heavily on who you're spending your money with.
And I think this is something to be careful of because of the trendiness of these ESG funds. A lot of the companies are starting to offer those to people and are starting to move people into these funds without them necessarily knowing. So I got a letter recently from the company that I have a pension with that I used to work for. And they said, oh, we're moving your fund over into this new ESG fund. If we don't hear from you within a week, we're just going to move it over. I was like, within a week, they were just going to move it. So I had to ring up and say, no, I'm not okay with that. Leave me in the in the existing fund, please. And we've seen that in another example as well. And someone that came on our Rebel Finance School sent us their fact sheet for the fund that they have. And I noticed that it said, oh, in May of this year, we changed the benchmark that this fund is based on. The benchmark is the thing that the index fund is trying to replicate. It's the people that say this are the weightings in the fund. We're going to change the benchmark to this new select ESG version. And they just changed it. And they've just suddenly like changed the fund and changed its whole philosophy because everyone's moving towards this. It's trendy. It's seen as the thing to be doing. So I think it's something to be very careful of, especially people might in the US have their 401k plans with their company. Just be very clear on what it is that they're investing your money in for you.
Yeah, agreed. And that's kind of what I was saying with what are we looking for when we invest in these funds? And again, just to make it perfectly clear, like I think I understand the cause. I think it's laudable. But as an investment, it's not a straight analog of a total stock market index fund. Or it's not even close. It is active stock picking. And yeah, if you're getting thrown into that automatically as if it were a straight analog of whatever fund you were in previously, which I assume is the lowest cost, most diversified one you had an option with, Katie. I mean, that's crazy town, you know?
Yes, I was annoyed.
Yeah, I believe it. I believe it. I love the British humor. I was annoyed, indeed.
I was slightly peeved.
Yes, slightly peeved. So let's go back just real quick to the inception of mutual funds, because I think this is actually where I was going with my question about market cap weighting. And maybe I'm kind of like barking up the wrong tree here or whatnot, but it seems as if there was a decision that was made at some point that cap weighting was the way and essentially the only way that we would run these funds. And I wonder if in your research, were there serious considerations to making it some other way? Again, not in your opinion necessarily, but in the research that you did, was it just such an obvious slam dunk that it had to be market cap weighted? Like, was that the only option, or was that an active decision in and of itself?
So there is a fabulous book called Trillions that charts the course of index funds, their inception, where they came from, all the way back to some French philosophers who decided you couldn't invest in the stock market and know which way it was going to go, way back before you thought of any of this, all the way through to the university people who studied the stock market, started to work it out, and then to Jack Bogle, who then eventually brought it to the masses, going, here's an index fund. To answer your question, there was hundreds of years of study into the best way to invest, and they looked at every particular way they could do it, and that was the way they decided was the best particular way for you to invest in those things. And that has what has generated the 10 to 12% average returns over the last 50 years or whatever it is, if you average it out over the period you had. And there was an interesting study recently that looked at what factors determine the success of an index fund over the long term. Sorry, the success of a fund. So not just an index fund, any fund, active funds, mutual fund, index fund, all of them. And do you know what the number one factor was that determined the long-term success of an index fund? The only statistically significant one.
In terms of the actual fund or an investor, or what are we talking about here?
Yeah, the actual fund, like all of the things they could look at. So the fees, the fund manager, the number of stocks it holds, the countries it invested in, they analyzed everything.
Yeah, I mean, fees would be my reflexive, easy answer, but we'll see.
That is the answer, fees. It was the only statistically significant proof that your fund would do well or not. Huh. And part of it was actively managed funds have higher fees. So if you pick lower fees, you are by definition getting more of a vanilla index fund, and those tend to do better over the long term. And the lower the fees, the more likely you are to be getting the simplest possible version. And if you're looking for the long-term predictor of success, fees seem to be the number one predictor.
Yeah, they certainly do. And for anybody who listened to the episode that we just did with J.L. Collins, I went through this example. So I'll do an abbreviated version here. But years ago on my original website, I came up with an example of $100,000 invested for 40 years. You start with $100,000 for 40 years, you add $1,000 a month, which seemed like a reasonable, okay, this could be someone in the financial independence community. I kind of assumed a probably too high of a return. I assumed a 9% gross market return. And just with that 9%, you'd have about 7.2 million with, at the time, VTSAX, which is wild to think about how significant that money is, right? With VTSAX having a 0.05 expense ratio at the time, which is actually higher than what it is, you'd have an 8.95% net return. And you lost about $100,000 to fees over 40 years, which sounds like a big number, but you'll see is not at all. And then if you had a typical fund that had a 1% expense ratio and you had an 8% net return, you would lose almost $2 million to fees. $2 million on $7 million. And if you doubled down and either bought a super expensive fund for 2% or had an investment advisor, let's say for 1%, so 2% total fees, you would actually lose $3.3 million of your 7.2. That's what a difference this makes. So very long story short, this can make a 30 to 50% difference in your compounded net worth at the end of the day. So fees matter, plain and simple.
100% agree. And I got geeky on this too and made a tool that allowed me to compare the fees on different funds. So I actually assumed the same return. So I looked at the S&P returns over the last 30 years. So it was just isolating the impact of fees, let alone the fact that most of the actively managed funds underperform the market. And you're right, the impact as those fees start to compound over the decades is outrageous.
Yeah, we worked out our first investments was with a flashy London investment advisor in a swanky suit. The fees were 2.21%. Ooh. And we worked out the difference between his fees and a standard index fund, and we would be 375 grand worse off. We would not have been FI if we'd have stayed with him. And like, you'd have trust in him. Like, he wears a suit, he's got a tie. Look at him, he must be trustworthy. And you put all your money with them, and then you realize, whoa. So that tool Katie's created, if anyone's listening wants to have a play with it, it's alandonegan.com/fees. That's all you have to type in. And you're able to like compare a Vanguard index fund or any type of vanilla index fund, any of the different ones, to what you're currently paying and see what the difference is over a different period, over decades. And it is fun to see. And if you want to persuade one of your family members who has a high fee investment, this is the tool to use.
Yeah, that sounds amazing. I keep going to the well of my article that I wrote up 9 years ago at this point. So maybe I'll start using that as kind of a real world scenario. That's really great. Katie and Alan, this has been amazing. I really, really appreciate all the deep dive that you've done and all these great pages on alandonegan.com that you both have worked on. And I think there might be a rebrand of the website in the not too distant future, which is cool.
To the Donegans.
I've come to play.
You certainly have, Katie. You certainly have. So yeah, all of the detail on the funds have been amazing. And we'll certainly, as always, throw it open to our community for any questions. If there are things that we didn't touch on, if there are items that people are interested about that just I didn't ask or we didn't touch on, always send me an email at feedback@choosefi.com. Or you can send a voicemail in at choosefi.com/voicemail. And we could definitely do this again very, very easily, the three of us.
If you were to give me extra stats homework, you don't know how happy that would make me. If you came and said, like, please, Katie, go away and analyze this thing, like, that would give me all the joy in the world. So please do give me some stats homework.
Maybe we should send it to katie@ellendonegan.com. I don't know if that's a real email address or not, but no, just kidding. So feedback@choosefi.com, send them on in or the voicemail. But just in closing, I wanted to touch on just one super quick thing. And I kind of had alluded to this with J.L. Collins, and I'm curious your thoughts. So one of the things that I think I try to keep in mind always, and I pride myself in, and I think the financial independence community does, is keeping an open mind and understanding the rules of the game, if you will, the rules of the world, seeing how things change and always being or trying to be a step ahead as opposed to reactive and reflexive. I wonder, have you ever contemplated a world where 50 years, 100 years from now, we say, oh, I understand why we made that decision at the time, that clearly that seemed like the best investing option, but we've learned more in the meantime. And okay, I get why in 2022 they did that. It's cute, it's quaint, but now we've moved on. Like, I know it's kind of a weird off the wall thought experiment, but I think some people have questions about problems with passive investing. And I'm conflating two different things here, but you hear this often, right? Like, oh, when everybody is a passive investor, the market's going to blow up, or, you know, you hear all this nonsense, right? Like, I'm curious your thoughts just on that broad topic. Like, do you see issues with passive investing? Any actual substantive issues with passive investing? And could you imagine a future where we say, okay, this isn't the best investing decision? I know that's hard to do because at the time we feel so strongly about it, but I'd love to hear your thoughts.
I think the thought that sparks in me is the importance to keep an open mind, because there is the danger of being in an echo chamber, especially when you dive into this financial independence world where we all talk about index funds and we all say like they are the way to go. And I end up most of my friends being in this community as well. So we, you know, it's always very important, yes, to keep an open mind and to seek out other opinions. But having said that, I think Alan's going to come in and slam down and say, index investing, do it.
Impossible.
So let's take Brad's exact thought experiment. In 100 years' time, do we know which companies, which industries will be the most dominant? The answer is no, we have no idea. Who knows? Cryptocurrency might be the biggest thing around. It may not. It may go to zero. It may go. I do not know what the biggest industries stroke companies will be. And index investing means I don't have to choose. All I'm doing is going, I'm going to own the most profitable of those. It might not even be companies. We might have a new structure by then, but I know I will own whatever that is and I will have that part of it. So I think the index fund says, I'm going to own whatever is the most profitable thing in the future. And that's the key. I'm not picking because I don't know. I don't know what's going to be most successful in the future.
It's probably something that doesn't even exist yet.
Yeah, it's definitely something that doesn't exist.
How new are all these dominant companies now?
Yeah, and we don't even know which dominant country. Like the US will probably still be a financial powerhouse, but there will be countries around the world that start mega companies that become successful. I'm not even picking them. All I'm saying is I'm going to own a chunk of all of it. And I think that's the piece. So the world will change, and I absolutely believe it will, and I'm just going to own whatever it changes to.
Yeah, that's a beautiful answer. I think both of your answers in combination are exactly how to look at this, right? Is we keep an open mind, we learn new things, we're always aware that things could change. But as Alan, you're saying, in this particular case, in your estimation, and in the estimation of many, the very nature of this type of fund and the fact that it's self-cleansing and automatically rebalances, et cetera, will make the structure of the fund the winner long-term. And we've seen it for now almost 50 years, is that right? Since Mr. Bogle invented the first index fund, it's somewhere in the vicinity of 50 years. So it's not impossible to believe, again, with the flexibility, the beautiful flexibility of this, that 50, 100 years from now, this is the dominant way of investing. And obviously, time will tell. We're open-minded. We're keeping abreast of this. And that's the important thing is we're always here to talk this through and to revisit it. And there are no sacred cows, in my opinion, in anything. I'm always looking to learn. And I think that that makes this fun, right? Like we're always looking to learn. We're always looking to learn new things. So it's just a much better way to go through life, in my opinion, than with like a very closed-minded doctrinaire, it has to be this way because it was decreed. So anyway, that's kind of my two cents. So Alan and Katie, co-founders, Rebel Finance School. We've obviously mentioned alandonegan.com multiple times, which might be rebranded at some point soon. But where can people find you? Tell us about the Rebel Finance School.
The Rebel Finance School was something Katie and I created in lockdown. We didn't have anything to do other than burpees and eating food. So we built the Rebel Finance School.
We did a lot of burpees together too.
Did let me say. I did the challenge. Yeah.
I think I ripped some chest cartilage amidst the thousands of burpees.
All I'm hearing is excuses.
Yeah. I did well for a short time.
And we decided, like, we hit financial independence 3 years ago. Katie quit her corporate job, I can't believe this, 5 years ago. And one of the things we've learned is part of happiness is purpose. So we wanted to have a purpose to help other people because finance is not a zero-sum game. So we can help other people get to financial independence. And the podcast, like your podcast, was so powerful for us and is such an incredible thing. And we wanted to do, like, our superpower is running courses. That's what I've done for the last decade. So we put a giant course online. We gave it away for free. 2,500 people came to the last 10-week course. And we gave it all away with the effort to help people sort out their finances. And that's what we've decided to do in retirement. Because you do need something to do in retirement. You can't sit on a beach with pina coladas continuously.
Agreed. Agreed. And would people find the Rebel Finance School at alandonegan.com or does it have its own website?
Yeah, or just Google it or alandonegan.com. You'll see a link to it on the homepage. We run it once a year. We give it away. Our friends come and help teach on the course. And we just help as many people as we can to sort their finances out and make progress. That's the whole purpose of this because it makes us happy. And also, it keeps us alive because people come with the questions, like you said, Brad. Should I be investing in an ESG fund or should I be investing in a standard fund? And the first year we went, I'm not really sure. Let us go away and answer that for you. And then you go to the data, you look it up, you work out what's happening.
You lost me for about 6 months.
Yeah, I did lose Katie for a long time to that one question. But you go away and you figure it out. So that live workshop environment where people are talking to us about what is actually going on is how we all learn together and are able to actually understand this stuff.
Yeah, people are always asking us questions that we hadn't thought about before, and it sends us scurrying away to do some research, do some analysis, come up with an opinion and go back to them. So it's constantly evolving, and that keeps it fun and interesting for everyone.
That is beautiful and amazing that you're giving that away for free. It's really cool. So yeah, everybody, I assume people can get on your email list, and since it only comes around once a year on alandonegan.com, they can find that out. So Katie and Alan Donegan, my friends, thank you so much for coming on.
Been awesome.
We've loved it. Brad, we love your podcast. Keep helping people with financial independence. What you do is incredible.
Thank you for listening to today's show and for being part of the Choosify community. If you haven't already, the best ways to get involved are, first, subscribe to the podcast. So you're listening to this on a podcast player. Just hit subscribe. And then subscribe to my weekly newsletter. I actually sit down every Monday and write this by hand, and I send it out Tuesday morning. So just head over to choosefi.com/subscribe. And it's really, really easy to get on the newsletter list right there. And I would greatly appreciate it. It's the best way to get in touch with me. You can actually just hit reply to any of those emails and it comes directly to my inbox. So that's the way that I keep a pulse of the community and how we keep this the ultimate crowdsourced personal finance show. And finally, if you're looking to join an in real life community, we have ChooseFI local groups in 300 plus cities all around the world. So head to choosefi.com/local and you'll find a list of all of those cities in 20 plus countries all across the world. And if you're just getting started with FI, or you have a family member or friend who you think would be interested, two easy ways. ChooseFI episode 100 is kind of our welcome to the FI community. And even though it's a couple years old at this point, it still stands up. And it's a really great just starting point to get an understanding of what is financial independence? What are we doing here? Why are we looking to live a more intentional life where we save money and use it as a springboard to live a better life? And then ChooseFI created a Financial Independence 101 course that's entirely free. Just head to choosefi.com/FI101. And again, thanks for listening.